I'm here with Gord Hill, and I wondered if you could introduce yourself.
Sure. Weeksus Gilakasla. My name is Gord Hill. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation, and my people's territory is on northern Vancouver Island in the so-called province of British Columbia.
You've done a lot of writing and work around decolonization, and often mainstream society has talked about 500 years of colonization on Turtle Island, and your work reminds people that it has been met with 500 years of resistance on the part of Indigenous peoples and original peoples of this land. Why is it important to bring light to history of resistance to the colonial settler consciousness?
Well, I think there's probably multiple reasons, but one reason is like the history of colonialism that's kind of taught by the colonial regime or the colonial schools and whatnot is basically like it portrays Indigenous peoples as being kind of helpless victims of this colonial process and just kind of being steamrolled by European colonialism. So the history of resistance is really important. On the one hand, it's kind of erased and minimized by the colonial history, so we forget that we have this history of resistance, and that history is really important to the present generations because it shows that our ancestors weren't just powerless and helpless; that they were also active combatants, like active fighters against this colonization, and that kind of really undermines the whole colonial myth that says that, you know, these two cultures met and there may have been some bad spots, but overall it was a mutually beneficial process, which was a big part of the 500 years, the celebration of the so-called discovery of the Americas in 1992. That was a big part of the narrative. So that's important, and that's one level of one reason about why it's important. But certainly it's really important to inspire the present generations that they know this history, that their ancestors fought, and because it really contributes to the present situation.
Thanks. And in your writing around colonization and decolonization, breaking it down for people to see how it's been made possible, in your manual 500 Years of Resistance, you've identified specific stages through which the process of colonization and decolonization are made possible, one of which in the process of decolonization is the occupation, the reoccupation of traditional territory. And what are some of the ways you see this reoccupation what are some of the ways you would see this reoccupation being made possible?
Well, I think we just look at some recent examples of the last 10 or 15 year period of different Indigenous nations going out to reclaim or reoccupy their traditional territory. One is in British Columbia with the Stadtlium Nation, who kind of reoccupied a part of their territory that was being targeted for a multi-million dollar ski resort. In 2000, they went in, they set up a small camp. It still exists to this day on what the government calls Crown land. So they've reoccupied their territory. They were successful in stopping the ski resort, and that's like one really positive example. Of course, the Six Nations land reclamation in 2006 is another example where they stopped the housing, the condominium development there. And in BC, there's other examples where groups go out. The New Hulk were going out. They were building pit houses and small longhouses in different parts of their territory to stop logging and to stop different tourist developments and whatnot. And it's important for people to do that because it gets them out onto their territory where they're going to be practicing their traditional skills. But it also keeps them aware of what's going on in their territory because logging companies can come in and people don't even know that this is happening, but if they're out on their territories using it, they're more aware of it and they're more able to defend that territory against these kinds of resource exploitation projects. The Sinek Nation is another one in the north or the southeastern corner of British Columbia. They've been declared extinct by the government, and they've had a reclamation camp there for over 20 years now. They've built a pit house there, and so that's another way of that they're kind of reclaiming territory and trying to establish themselves that they're not an extinct nation, that they still exist, they're still a sovereign Indigenous nation. So those are those are some different examples.
Do you think the fact that BC is unceded territory and is engaged in now modern treaty making, but do you think that changes the opportunities for reclamation of land?
Well, in British Columbia, there's a very high level of consciousness among Indigenous people about this aspect of the colonial history, that there were no treaties made for most of the province. So this informs a lot of the Indigenous struggles, and in that when they go to defend territory or resources or whatnot, they have this understanding that there are no treaties. The land was so blatantly stolen. So that's why, like during Oka 1990. BC had the most amount of solidarity blockades and occupations and protests and whatnot in solidarity with the Mohawks, because the local people, Indigenous people in BC, like, were able to relate their local struggles very easily with the struggle of the Mohawks to defend their last little bit of the pines there in Gonesitagi. So it definitely is a big factor in Indigenous struggles in BC.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about warrior culture and the need to promote this and keep it alive. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about what that means to you.
Well, for me, it means like that, you know, we have to define what a warrior is, because there's all kinds of different interpretations. So for Indigenous people, a warrior is a person who goes out. Their role is to defend their territory and their people and their way of life. And it distinguishes this Indigenous warrior from like gangsters or soldiers or different people who just engage in violence or fighting or some kind of combative aspect. So it has a purpose, and the purpose is to defend the people and the territory. And today we struggle a lot to try to maintain this aspect of Indigenous culture, because it was very central to most Indigenous peoples had a warrior culture, and this is another aspect that's been erased and minimized by the colonial regime. And you can see today with the modern manifestations of a warrior society, particularly with the Haudenosaunee and the Mohawk, how criminalized and demonized it is, because that's one thing the state doesn't want, is this warrior culture to reassert itself. So it's a very important part of Indigenous resistance, because if you don't have a fighting spirit, a warrior culture, then you will lack the will to resist. So it's very, very fundamental.
Mm-hmm. And Andrea Smith has written about warrior culture and the idea that the warriors have always existed in Indigenous culture, but contrary to Eurocentric versions of warriorhood, the goal was often about honor and not about the annihilation of another group.
Well, certainly, when the first European colonists came here and they engaged in warfare with Indigenous people, they saw Indigenous warfare as like being like a game, like it was a skulking way of war, like sneaky. It wasn't like the gentleman's way of waging war. But, because at the time, the 1600s, the European military tactics were basically to form a large group and to march into an open field and to face another large group and then open fire. And that's where the term cannon fodder comes from. It's like these soldiers are just being sent in as pawns to be mowed down by the enemy. But when the Indigenous people got firearms and were engaging in their anti-colonial warfare against the Europeans, the whole way of European warfare had to change, because they were being subjected to ambushes and raids, like classic guerrilla warfare that Indigenous people just naturally adopted and began using. So there was a big change, but before colonialism, most Indigenous warfare had very low casualties, because when you're living in these smaller communities that relying on hunting and gathering, this kind of way of life, you can't afford to have large casualties. So it's often, as soon as there was some people were wounded or killed, the conflict would be ended, because they wanted to preserve their population, the personnel. So it was a very, very different way of waging war. The European form of warfare, of course, is very genocidal, and they were intent on massacring or killing off Indigenous people to take their land. And so it's a very different form of warfare than what Indigenous people engaged in, definitely.
And the Unist'ot'en camp of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and their allies have been physically resisting the two major pipelines that'll go through their territory unless they're shut down, the Pacific Trails and the Enbridge Northern Pipeline, by building a cabin and physically opposing the building of these pipelines. So they have the action camps and gatherings, and I'm wondering if you know about what's coming up for them or what the current situation there looks like.
Well, at the present, my understanding is the Pacific Trails Pipeline They're trying to send in survey teams to begin marking out the path of the pipeline, so where the logging would begin to occur and whatnot. And these survey teams have been evicted by the Unistaten clan of the Wet'suwet'en. So that's been ongoing for a while now. Earlier this month, they had another work party to build a pit house in the path of the pipeline, because I think they've altered it slightly since last year when they built a cabin that was directly in the right-of-way of the proposed pipeline. And they're going to have another gathering this summer in July, I believe. So they're still building their capacity, and they're trying to establish these physical camps, like on the land in the path of the pipeline. So that's still something in development. And the Pacific Trails Pipeline is the first of seven pipelines that are proposed across this particular region of central BC. So it's viewed as a trailblazer for the Enbridge pipeline. But one thing that the Unistaten clan of the Wet'suwet'en are facing is that a lot of the band councils who oppose Enbridge are actually partners with the Pacific Trails pipeline, which is a natural gas pipeline. It's going to be running natural gas from northeastern BC, where a lot of fracking is going on right now, and it's really degrading the land and environment up there. So that's basically what I understand the situation is now.
Mm. And I'm wondering if there is a specific link that you'd be able to make between violence against the land and against Indigenous peoples by the nation state and the violence that we see with missing and murdered Indigenous women and sexual violence against Native women, and how land exploitation is also linked at women being at further risk of violence.
Well, I think one of the foundations of this kind of colonial sexualized violence and whatnot, I think you can go back to the origins of Western civilization, and in particular, like the Christian religion, which is very patriarchal, which sees the earth and the natural world as something that needs to be controlled and conquered, and it plays into the idea of civilization, which is like large-scale agriculture, establishment of permanent settlements, and the rise of the city-states. So I think you can go that far back in the history of Western civilization to see this basic principle that Mother Earth is an object that needs to be conquered and exploited for the benefit of man. And I think that kind of patriarchal religion worldview, it's still very much in effect today. And I think when you get into a colonized situation, the ongoing situation of missing and murdered, mostly Indigenous women, it's very prevalent across the country. Vancouver has been well known because of there was like over 70 missing and murdered women, and then Picton was charged and convicted for six of these killings. But up on Highway 16, where a lot of the pipeline routes are proposed, there's like over 30 missing and murdered women. Edmonton's got the same situation. Winnipeg, Regina, they all got the same situation. Most major cities in North America have the same situation. It may not be Indigenous women, it's Black or Latino women. It's all an aspect of this patriarchal system, and I think that they're very interrelated. And the whole colonialism, it's like you even look at the Indian Act, one of its purposes was to undermine the whole matrilineal culture that Indigenous people had, and to impose a patriarchal system where the men were going to be the elected chiefs. So I think it's very much a part of the Indigenous struggle, and I think there's been a lot of efforts made in the last few years to really grasp this idea that women are really central to and a vital aspect of protecting the environment and protecting the land and whatnot, and reclaiming our humanity. Mm-hmm.
Decolonization certainly takes a commitment on both the part of Native and non-Native communities, and I'm wondering if there's something that you would like to see non-Native communities do in attempts to decolonize or be in solidarity.
I don't really have anything particular. I mean, I think anti-capitalist resistance is a form of decolonization. The anarchist movement, I think, is a form of decolonization. So, just overall anti-system resistance, anti-capitalist resistance, anti-colonial resistance. I mean, I think these are very important, very important analyses that we need to incorporate and move forward with and try to infect the rest of the population with this. And I think, you know, as the economy, the socioeconomic conditions decline, it's going to be more, create more fertile grounds for this, that we, you know, we'll have greater opportunities to promote these ideas. And I think that's really vital to, you know, to the survival and resistance that, you know, that's what the situation that we're entering into is going to require.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, thanks so much.
Okay. Yeah, Gila Kessler.